Commissioners meetings.
Right, yeah, and it could be part of that.
Oh, this, yeah, they're over there. This one says, ask me about Clark Park. So they're like different parts of the. Front center. I know what question. And then right. I actually got my phone out. Phone out to sort of. Yeah. It is, yeah, sorry. It's gonna be on a Zoom. Hey, guys.
Thank you so much.
Hey, good to see you. Hello. I haven't seen you forever.
My close, the other page up here is the picture of all the chat rooms. So it's your first day Berman picture, I think, up there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't know. In some ways, I'm feeling like we're not efficient.
Yeah.
This is, I'm not certain about what's happening. So, I might call them. If it's a question related to sociology or public history, you're up.
I'm going to report out of the written message in chapter one, and that was fine. But others were saying, right, so work on that if you can go on, but I just want to figure out. I'm not going to read it all that. I don't know, I think by the time you finish it, I've been in LA for a week.
No, this is awesome.
thought. Where are you?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm George Shields, the University Provost, and it's my honor to welcome you all here today to hear from the task force. I want to start by thanking the task force for this tremendous work that they've done. On Friday, I went to the Confederate Museum in Greenville, and I was just stunned by the way history can be portrayed in our community. And it illustrated for me why it's so important that the task force has done the work that it has done, and why we have a very esteemed group of faculty and staff who worked on this. And it's my privilege to introduce to you now the lead historian for the task force. Steve O'Neill did a fantastic job working on history. And so I'm going to invite Steve to come up now and start going. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, George. It's good to see such a robust crowd here today. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to make my remarks very brief because we want this to be interactive. What I'm going to do is speak in defense of the overall effort and then add a quick word about the recommendations themselves. The criticisms that I've heard have typically been not about the report itself or even the recommendations. You may hear something different today, and I certainly invite you to bring all your concerns to the floor here. That's why we're here. But rather, most criticism has been on whether the whole idea and the whole enterprise was a good idea. The question's been asked, why dredge up this uncomfortable aspect of our past? Why focus on these negative things? Let's focus on the positive things. Let's move forward. Let's promote the good name of Furman and focus on the good things. So let me see if I can, in a very brief time, just remind us why it's important for us as a community and as a university to reckon with this difficult, even grim aspect of our history. We expose injustice in the past not to condemn, not to indict our predecessors or our ancestors, but in the hope that we can explain the past in a way, or explain the past to the present in a way that helps us make better decisions, more informed decisions about how we want to act in the present and the future. Pick up a button up there. The one that I chose is asking about reckoning. We decided in our committee very purposefully to choose the verb reckon to describe how we wanted to relate to this discomforting past. And I think reckoning connotes both understanding, but it also emphasizes responding to our new understanding, to our new level of understanding, responding in an appropriate fashion. So we have calculated what happened by doing the history and making the report, but by reckoning, we also pledge to deal with it in a way that brings that past into our present. The recommendations are a response to that part, to this part of reckoning. They are a statement that we've examined this discomforting past, and that we are hereby pledging not to forget it. And I think if you look at the recommendations, they're a combination of both symbolic measures, but also specific and very practical measures. So here today, I hope our discussion will be freewheeling, it will be wide open. I want every objection to be heard. But in the end, I think it's very important that we as a campus community show unity, that we can rally strongly behind the recommendations in a way that will send a strong message that we stand as students, as faculty, as staff, as everybody in the Furman community, we stand strongly behind these recommendations. With that, I want to invite my esteemed colleague, Teresa Cosby, up to say her piece.
Good afternoon, and thank you for being here. I'm here just to remind everyone that there was a process
in reaching these recommendations, and the process started with the history that Steve wrote, because we thought it was very important not to try to jump ahead of what the story of Herman was and make recommendations without fully understanding our history. And it's from that history that we make these recommendations. We had a lot of outside guidance from consultants who came and met with us or talked with us from a distance. Some were alum of Herman, but some were from communities who had gone through the same process that we're going through now. We had a number of educational opportunities across the campus last year so that we could prepare the community for what other institutions had gone through and what potentially we may go through. Importantly, our committee was comprised of faculty, staff, and students. So we wanted the vantage point of all of the sectors of the Herman landscape. And very importantly, this project was started by a student voice and a student encouragement that we examined our history and our connection with the past. And it's something that I hope students understand about the power of their position and their power in society, and that their voice can have meaning and that their voice can be transformative as they move forward in society. And with that, I'm going to invite a student up, Chelsea McKelvey, to give you the student perspective.
Hi, everyone. For those who don't know me, my name is Chelsea McKelvey. I'm a senior in Spanish and History, double major from Charleston, South Carolina. And being from Charleston, I definitely recognize the importance and value of representation in the landscape, and that's why I motivated myself to focus on campus landscapes as part of my contributions to this task force. As detailed in the piece of report that I co-authored with Dr. Whitlinger, in Charleston on Calhoun Street, there is a 115-foot pedestal upon which stands a statue of John C. Calhoun. Calhoun was the 7th Vice President of the United States, and he was also a staunch defender of slavery. His being perched upon that pedestal, for me, is uncomfortable because it suggests a certain ownership of my home. But that discomfort is also what motivates and informs my contributions as a member of this task force. And I think that with the increasing population of African-American students at Herman, representation within our campus landscape definitely matters. It creates a sense of belonging, which I think all students seek during one point in time during their college career and experience. I also believe that the most readily available example of Black excellence in Furman's history is Greenville native Joseph Vaughn. He was Furman's first African-American student, serves as a beacon of hope for myself amongst other students. For students, representation of themselves that are more reflective of the climate in which we now live and strive to live in are paramount. I believe that the recommendations are reflective of these needs and will create an even more inclusive campus culture. I am so thankful that you all are here today. I commend you all for embracing the work of this task force, and I'm definitely incredibly encouraged by the momentum that our community has created through their curiosity and desire to know how to serve justice to peoples who have been intergenerationally disadvantaged. I hope that our community remains excited and curious, and that our administration will continue their meaningful support of the work of this task force. And I also hope that this excitement and momentum will be translated into hasty action on our recommendations. So with that, I thank you all for being here today, and I hope that we're able to have a really meaningful discussion.
All right, I'm Brandon and Adlin, but you probably already knew that, and I was sharing this process. Why don't the task force members in the room just stand up so we can recognize you? And I'd like to give them a round of applause. With you. I should mention too, so for those who came in the room late, there's copies of the report. Actually, we'll have more of them, but copies of the report, overviews, and buttons over there. And also, the website was just fixed today. And so we have even more web pages for your information if you're interested in sort of afterwards finding out more. This, let me just show you real quickly. We just created an internal deferments website at Seeking Abraham Project set of pages. So everything that we were working on over the past year is now in the firm website, which is a good home for it. And so that's recorded here. We've got lots of multimedia. So those of you who aren't already integrating some of this into your classes, this is a really great resource to use. And then, of course, the page you probably all saw, which was mailed out by Elizabeth Davis and others on behalf of the university, that's the homepage for the task force. And we hope to continue that kind of public presence, obviously, in digital spaces. And so with that, we want to open it up for questions. Obviously, as chair, I was the sort of the intersection piece, and I relied on the task force to do so much, to get the history right, to get the right words in the report. So I hope you see it as an example of a lot of diligent work that went into it, but it's certainly something that can be critiqued. And so although we heard those on the task force say, we hope you like it, we're hoping you're open to this sort of excitement of the report, we do want this also to be a rigorous conversation and a critical conversation. So if you're feeling like there's something that you need to say that, now you're going to steal the thunder or the sort of momentum of the room, feel free to say that. It should be a space where we all feel comfortable. That's kind of the point of the project, right, is to be comfortable with our history and to be able to talk about it, even in its discomfort, even in its hardest times. So with that, let me just open it up to the floor for questions.
Yeah, I'm going to actually pass this right.
I'm so nervous. So I'll admit, I skimmed the report and got all the recommendations, so if this is already in there, my apologies, but one of my first thoughts looking at the recommendations about statues and historical markers was that we should make sure to consider if we can get those items created by local minority artists and craftspeople, or make sure that the contribution today is not just, a bunch of white people making those markers and making those statues we wanted, or alumni would also be great, but alumni artists who are, also people of color. So I just want to make sure that we take the lesson from the past and be inclusive in getting those made, if that is something that
you want. George, I was going to get you up here in the hot seat too. Because one of the things that we have to talk about is sort of how do these get implemented? And George has a better sense of that than I do. Our job as a task force was to create the report and to offer the recommendations. And so questions about who is chosen, that's going to be an open and ongoing question, but I think that is an important value.
Well, just in terms of process, the trustees meet at the end of October, and as I understand it right now, they're planning to set up a special committee that will meet with the task force, understand the recommendations, understand the history so that they understand why the recommendations are what they are, and then they will study it. And some of the recommendations I'm sure we'll implement right away, and others they'll want to think about it a little harder before we decide. But late October will really be their first time when they start to dig into this and they start thinking hard about the report itself and the recommendations, because it's the first chance they'll have had to meet since the report was issued. So I expect that we'll have an announcement after the trustees meeting. They'll endorse the report, they'll thank the task force, and then they'll set up this process that will be ongoing for us to be thinking about. As far as the recommendations and who's in charge, we're working right now on a list to decide what are things that the trustees have to vote on, and what are the things that the administration can say, well, we can do this, and what are things that are recommendations that the faculty can do and the faculty administration can do together. And so we'll run that by the trustees and make sure that we have thought that through appropriately, and then we'll start implementing the recommendations.
It might be nice to create a kind of an advisory guide for how that should be done based on recommendations like that.
Yeah, it is. That's perfect.
I want to go to the time first.
Can you hear me? I had meetings all day, so I didn't have time to prepare what I'm trying to say. But first, let me say, I think it was last year when the keynote speaker at our MLK event was Naomi Tutu. And she remarked something very important, and that was that in America, too often we teach history so that we can feel good about it, as opposed to finding the truth in the study of history. I think, unfortunately, there's a good amount of truth to that, and I so much appreciate that we're breaking away from that and are venturing to find the ever more truth in our history so as to be able to learn from that. Now, I want to say something about the recommendations. I think they're very good, and I don't see them as very controversial at all. In fact, I think many of them will benefit from in various kinds of ways. So they're very good. However, I want to suggest that they may fall a bit short, and here's why. Try and make it short. In the 1960s, Furman faced a choice when it came to desegregation. We could have done the right thing, but we chose not to. When the compelling forces became strong enough, ultimately we did. But it wasn't a voluntaristic choice. It was a compelled choice. We did because we had to. We didn't do it because it was right. And I think something similar we're facing today. Slavery ended in some way, but not in other ways. Many scholars argue it was just transformed. Out of slavery became lynching, and out of lynching became mass incarceration. So there's different forms of slavery continuing today. When we take the example of mass incarceration, there's a tremendous amount of profit to be made from that. Scholars speak of the prison industrial complex, for example, which there's many corporations invested for profit. We can think of other examples, corporations that benefit from cheap labor, from exploitative labor in the United States and across the world. We can think of corporations who are benefiting from violence and from war, and from the subjugation of often brown and black people around the world. We may more or less be invested in some of these corporations. As long as we remain invested in these corporations through our endowment, I think we're continuing to be complicit in something that is morally reprehensible. So I think the question still poses itself today. We don't have slavery in the traditional form, but we have oppression of people here in the United States and elsewhere. And I believe we are possibly complicit in that. And so what I would set forth, unless there is a systematic investigation of our endowment and to what extent we are invested in these corporations who are benefiting from mass incarceration, from violence, from war, from cheap labor, from exploitative labor, we're failing to come to a, Steve used that word, reckoning. We're failing to come to a full reckoning. And in the future, it may be a retrospective similar like we're now looking at the 1960s when we failed to make the right decision, or at least venture towards that decision. So these are my comments. But thank you very much for your excellent work on this report. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ikan. Does anyone want to take that one? I don't want to respond to all the questions. If there are others in the room who want to be a part of the conversation, feel free just to sort of raise your hand. We did offer a recommendation in that direction, and I think, you know, one of the things is the critiques of that recommendation. So what we said was that we should put into our financial endowment policies ESG screening, environmental, social, and governance screening process. And in talking to the endowment manager, it's complicated. Furman is a mid-sized institution, and so it's not easy for us to do what a Harvard or Yale could do, which is to hire the people on our staff who would go out and actively screen this stock, not that stock, right, and run the data and run the reports on it. On the other hand, we're not so small and don't have such a small endowment that we could just say, well, let's just put it in this one fund. It's safe from all that, right? And so as I understand it, and again, this is me, the humanities professor, trying to explain, as I understand it, we're in sort of this middle range, which is pretty difficult to deal with this question. And the best we can do as an institution is to rely on our managers to make those decisions for us and to tell them, this is the kind of criteria that we want you to go looking for as you do this work. And there are plenty of funds and managers who are willing to do that. Obviously, we have to put the financial cues in place for that to happen, and also the policy in place. And so one thing that starts with is that there's a financial subcommittee of the Board of Trustees. We recommended that they clarify the policy. Right now it says that they might take that into consideration, and we'd like some stronger wording there that says we will take this, we will make this a priority to monitor for ESG factors. And then I think, Akon, to your point, I think a lot of what has to happen beyond that is the kind of data, and this is for all of us, the kind of educational opportunities that come with that, right? So if the trustees make that sort of commitment, then the opportunities for maybe our business and accounting students and our economics students open up to, okay, let's participate more in a process. Let's help screening, or at least be aware of what we're screening for and against. And I think that's where, as an institution, we could do really well in the long term. Short term, I think a policy change is a relatively first change. Longer term, I think, getting those departments and those minds working with our endowment office would be a really nice thing to see. And I think that's what captures kind of the spirit of the task force. Any follow-up there? ESG factors. Wes and the Shai Center folks can definitely say this is in line with a lot of what they've been looking for a while. So I think we've got a confluence of interest between those two departments. Thank you.
Hi, thanks, Brendan. I want to thank the committee for all the hard work that y'all have done. Those of you who I know and have seen the hard work, it's been very impressive. I'd like to also thank the university for the courageous decision to pursue this. It was courageous. I think the report is excellent. I endorse the, I'm excited about the recommendations. I would offer one additional recommendation. It seems to me that for a university, where the rubber meets the road is in the curriculum. Things that we've heard in the media over the last couple of years as white nationalism has come back onto the scene in an unexpected, surprising way. One of the things that I hear is in debates about the past is that things like slavery wasn't all that bad, and then picking up on Akon's point, that lynching and Jim Crow, lynching was not all that often, and Jim Crow wasn't all that bad, and that those kinds of statements are based in complete ignorance. And that's a challenge that a university can help with, because that's what we do, is we dispel ignorance. I would like to see an initiative that encourages professors to consider how they can work knowledge of the actual conditions of slavery knowledge of the actual conditions of Jim Crow, knowledge of lynching. I would like to see an initiative that encourages professors to work those things into their syllabi in ways that are appropriate for the subject matter of the course. Those of us who've been around for a while remember that about 10 years ago, the university had an initiative where I was encouraging professors to bring sustainability into their syllabi, right? And there was small grants available to professors so that they could rework syllabi. I think if the university were to put forth an initiative like that to encourage professors to, in appropriate ways, to bring the actual conditions of slavery into their course. And then those are courses in sociology, in philosophy, in history, in literature, many courses in departments throughout the university, we could be doing this. And in that way, there would be many, many more Furman students educated to the point where they could take on that kind of ignorant statement that slavery wasn't that bad. And spell that ignorance. Thank you.
So I think that's a great idea for curricular implementation. And faculty, you control the curriculum, so that's something that the faculty can work on, and administration will certainly support those efforts. I want to tell you that this weekend I started reading Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Classroom or the Cafeteria? Beverly Daniel Tatum wrote this in 1997. She went on to become president of Spelman for quite a long time. And she just wrote a 20th anniversary edition, which she published in 2017. So last year, about this time, it came out. And she has a prologue in there that's about 75 pages long, where she goes over the last 20 years. And she talks about the legacy that's come from slavery and Jim Crow and everything else. And while she is in general positive, she talks about three things that have happened over the last 20 years, which I think should be part of the education of our students. One is the dismantling of affirmative action that's happening everywhere. People don't understand history, therefore they don't understand why affirmative action isn't a dirty word, a dirty phrase. Right, but most Americans are against affirmative action because they do not understand our history. The second thing that has caused a lot of problems for trying to educate minority and underrepresented students everywhere is the Great Recession. The housing collapse impacted the poorest segments of our society, so the subprime disaster was a real problem. For all of our families that were living close to the poverty line to begin with, and then many of them lost their jobs right after that as well. So that's resulted in a huge loss of wealth among people who had the least to lose. And then the last thing she talks about is the industrial prison complex, which Hakan talked about just a moment ago, and that's had horrible repercussions when so many black men are locked up in jail. So I do think that building on what we've done and talking about our history and making sure that we have this in the curriculum is a very important part of it, every educational institution, and particularly Furman's.
I'll just add one thing the task force was also trying to make sure we did was to create a positive narrative for the people that experience that subjugation. And thinking of examples, and some of the buttons will say things like "Ask me about Clark Murphy," "Ask me about Abraham," just to humanize it some, because I think half of our student body are gonna, and just the sort of natural human condition, right? They're gonna turn off their ears and think, "Oh my gosh, this is such negative stuff. I can't. On top of my stress in my life, I don't know that I can deal with that." And I think there's that important curricular part too, which is here's why it's not just here's how bad things were. There's also look at these individual stories of achievement under that bad system, and people working to make a better life for themselves. People who contributed in amazing ways, and so that's a tough thing, and I think it's a tough thing to teach well. And so I think your idea is really a great one to have ways to talk about that, because I think it's not something that's
you know, most of us can go find, you know, something like an Atlantic article or something that sort of says, yes, there's this very bad history out there, but then to actually engage students on it, to have them feel like this is something they want to be a part of rather than this is, you know, you should feel bad about this, is tough. And no one's mastered that, but we've attempted as a task force to try to insert some talking points there, right? Insert some, here are the people, here's the lived experience of what this looked like, to try to make that better. But a terrific idea. And any other questions or comments on that one?
Thank you so much for this. This is my second year as a faculty, and I've never seen something like this in the places I went to graduate school and undergrad. So this is really special. And for a faculty who teaches philosophy of race, this is detrimental for making it relevant to the university as one of my students. Is there a possibility there could be like a connected group or extra group where we can talk about how all the ways we can integrate this in our curriculum, and maybe the, you know, roadblocks or different interdisciplinary opportunity amongst faculty, and it would be great to have students in a part of it where we can have an ongoing conversation back and forth with the findings as well as re-envisioning curriculum within the three contexts.
That's my question. That sounds like a perfect learning community out of the Faculty Development Center. And so I would encourage you to contact me again. And I think she would be excited to potentially spend time here.
Mindfulness session.
Anything.
she's being mindful right now.
I just want to say that I commend the university on the diversity efforts and the faculty and staff, but I see faculty and staff as students. That's my problem with it. Like, I appreciate the university, I appreciate our faculty, I appreciate our staff, but it's just the students, some of the students here that don't, like us, don't see the problem with this, and we're not teaching it, and it's just like, it's not an issue because people don't talk about it here. And students try to avoid this, and it just makes us really uncomfortable being in these classrooms talking about these topics, and people don't know about some of these things. And it's like a forced effort is placed on you to educate these people, and it shouldn't be our job to educate them all. Like, they should be feeling responsible. They should want to go learn about these things, and they should come. And it shouldn't just be a faculty effort. It should also be a student effort. Like, I see it. I see you guys. But, like, where are the students that look like you? I don't see it. And it really hurts that not many people showed up in that aspect. Because those are the people that we live with, the people that we eat with, the people that we see every day, the people that we interact with, and they're not here. I want to know what the university is doing to get the students like involved with this versus you just make a faculty effort, the people who care, like get everybody to care.
So I do hear you and understand that, but I think that is kind of a component of what Dean Peterson is talking about. The faculty needs to take control of how we implement students of all races, classes, whatever, into this conversation and try to invigorate student interest across all racial paradigms. I clearly understand the sensitivity that you have if we bring up this topic, that every white student in the class looks to you and say, can you become the explainer of every variable of something that happens among African American communities, with this Hispanic student, and Hispanic student becomes the explainer. And so that becomes incumbent upon faculty to understand that this dynamic occurs. And one of the reasons that we want a critical mass of students who look different from the mainstream of students is so that we don't have this isolation on the campus. But now we have to deal with the apathy that you sense about this topic. And that's the commitment and the charge I think the task force felt in moving this out of the task force across the campus landscape into the classrooms and integrate all students into this conversation. And so that becomes a really particularly tough piece of this, isn't it? To get other students to understand this dynamic and what it means. And the fact that you're here and you have
Yeah, Asha, let's keep going with students. That's a voice we want to hear.
Hello. So I just want to say again, like everybody, thank you. I think this is extremely relevant and necessary work. And so I love being able to be here and listen to this. I wanted to add on to Q's point. I feel like, and I've only been here a hot minute, so. I feel as though my culture in specific tends to straddle between the line of invisibility or hypervisibility, and it's always between those points here on campus. And so I was just wondering if this slavery and justice task force will move from telling the history, which is, it will have to, into more of like bringing culture here on campus, like cultivating that culture. So like a big thing that we've been talking about is like bringing the divine right back on campus, the divine stories. And doing more than just like entertainment events like Trap and Paint and stuff like that. And I was just wondering like if that will become a facet of the task force as we move on, just cultivating that culture on campus, our culture.
I should say
Trap and
Paint.
Trap and Paint.
You're gonna have to educate me.
Yeah, that'd be great, Michael.
Bringing, as a matter of fact, for your example, bringing back some of the Divine Eye and historically African-American organizations back to campus is something that we're actively working on. We find ourselves a bit of a conundrum having low numbers of African-American students and needing those numbers higher to sustain the organizations. Then we need the organizations to get the numbers of students, so it becomes circular. So we're trying to interrupt that circular flow and get the organizations back active on campus, because I know that you know that we're a lot to campus for the entire campus. It would be a good thing. We're looking at a strategic diversity plan. So out of some of these recommendations, you haven't seen anything that mentions a specific strategic diversity plan for the future, but we want to take this look at the past and kind of use it as a way to reflect on our present and then going forward. So then what are we going to do now? What are we going to do? And that's what's going to be emerging over the next several months is the strategic diversity plan about how to move forward. Not just the recommendations that you've heard, but about things to change the quality of life on campus and get more diverse community.
And just to that point, I mean, again, you won't see a lot of that because that's Michael's job in the future, is to figure out the strategic diversity report. But one thing you would see was the Joseph Fong Scholarship, putting $1 million of university finances there. And I think that sort of thing will bring the quantity of students that we need to make some of those opportunities possible. So that's a hopeful spot in this particular report.
Good afternoon. I'm really excited about this project because it really became pretty personal when I had a conversation with Brandon and realized that Brandon once had a home in the county, Sumter County, where I grew up. And it is hard to think about because I've had to ask myself, if Furman University had remained there, how would it change the landscape of the community in which I grew up in? To go to that historical site the last time I was home to realize, oh, this is why we have a Furman High School, why we have a Furman Field Road, and all of these things associated with the university. So, one of my questions is, I see one of the recommendations is reconnecting with those communities. Has any thought been given to what that potentially would look like? I know for myself, automatically, it was like, one, nobody knows. So that history piece is definitely necessary, but I think it's also going to be very strategic to where you're welcome back into those communities as well. So that's one of the major things. And also looking at those intentional partnerships, like you mentioned, getting connected with HBCUs. So there's a prime example. You have Morris College there. So there's already a major link that could be built there. But I do think it's important that as we're going, is trying to think of the best way to say this, you don't want to go in and comes across as that white is right, because a lot of our communities are still struggling with that. And like I said, having grown up in Sumter County, it's still a huge, huge, huge issue there in different ways. So I'm just kind of curious if any thought has been given to that yet.
I would say three of the recommendations could work in tandem to do a nice job of that. One is the kind of work you're already doing, which is recruiting. And I think you guys are targeting a slightly area slightly north of there. And we've called out those areas where Furman once existed, right? We said that's really where we want to put our energy in terms of scholarship and recruitment, is places where we were running the plantation, or at least our faculty or our donors and that group were running the plantations back in the day. So we have a historical reason to be in those communities today, rather than just sort of, you know, looking at a map and saying, okay, there's a spot. You know, we actually did a study, so it wasn't that haphazard, but as you know. Reconnecting with that history. So that's number one, is the scholarship and the, you know, basically the gateway that says we do want you, step one. Step two, I think, is programming, and that's the facilities kind of recommendation that, as you said, just bringing attention to the fact that we were there. Genealogy in the community, saying we're part of your history and we want to run workshops, we want to talk about this some, we want to have events with our historians at your historical societies that talk about what Furman was like in the community. And then I think the third one, if, you know, again, kind of a well-rounded approach here, is the genealogy summer opportunity, right? So that a summer scholars kind of program could say, it's not just your community or this region that we're looking at, it's you specifically, you have a link here, right? And that Furman has the tools and the knowledge to give you back some history that was probably taken from you. And if we can do that, if we can offer like to 10th graders, let's say, in their summertime, come to Furman for a week or two, learn about your past in a broad scale from our historians and others, and then dive into your specific what you have, what records you have. Let's go back as far as we can and figure that out for you. I think that would be really meaningful. And I think with those three programs, you can imagine a little bit beyond that kind of like, oh yeah, we're kind of interested in those spots. We'll do that one lecture. And if we can be systematic, I think that would be a really nice thing to see. But that takes all of those, a lot of those recommendations coming together.
Hello. This is more in response to the students, and I know all these folks because they come in the message of representing meetings, but the work that we're doing in the CIC and helping to advocate support our underrepresented students in particular, create space for them to feel like they belong, feel like they're celebrated. That's why we launched this venture last August, and so I just want to know that I hear you and that I'm here to support you, we're here to support you in the center. We're creating programming that aims to complement, hopefully the curricular experience for students. So with our new dialogue program, creating space to talk about issues of race in our history in particular, for students, it's really uncomfortable for our white students, and uncomfortable for us also sometimes, but creating space for us to have dialogue surrounding these issues, so complementing hopefully what's going to be ingrained in the curriculum with our workshop series that covers lots of different topics related to diversity and inclusion, and to new programming for all of our students, but then on the flip side of that, creating space for students to talk about things that you're experiencing here in and outside the classroom. So just want to let you know that I continue to support you, and at any point, if there are faculty who want us to just change what our dialogue program has to come to your classes and facilitate, this is a peer facilitated program. Emily O'Brien and I just have a post back for social justice
and just speaking from the faculty, to have students say that directly to you, that you're not incorporating a certain part of history in your classroom or a certain experience in America in the classroom or something like that, that's way more meaningful than hearing it from other faculty. Because when I hear from other faculty, I think, well, yeah, but you're the historian that's trained to do that, or you're the scholar who specifically deals with that issue. And if I hear from a student, I feel the kind of personal weight of it. Like, oh my gosh, my texts are all by white guys. And I never thought about that before. It's just my field where I was trained. I never actually thought about that. So I would encourage you to speak up to them. It's way more meaningful when it comes from a student than if I were to just sort of chat with my colleagues and say, you know, you should do a little more of that. And they say, yeah, but really I don't know where to go and all this. Student says it, they say, okay, this is serious now. I've got to go do the research. I've got to figure out what I need to be doing. So speak up about those things.
I'm so excited to
come to Furman this particular year. It's my first year here, and be engaged in the wonderful work that Furman's doing here. I wanted to say that there's so much more to be discovered than we know yet, and it's thrilling how much more we can know about this history. Emily Little, I see, is in here. Emily's in my first year writing seminar, and she discovered Abraham Sims' death certificate, which tells us where he was born, who his parents were, where they lived, a whole bunch of information that we didn't know until Emily discovered it. And another one of our students in the class, Catherine, is just uncovering the history behind Abraham Sims' wife, Dora, who appears to have been the daughter of Benjamin Brutton, which connects the university intimately with Bruttontown. Benjamin Brutton was the carpenter, he was a blacksmith who helped build that important part of African-American history here in Greenville. So what I'm suggesting is we as teachers and our talented students have so much more to uncover and ways in which we are invested because you all were smart enough to direct us to think about this. So I just encourage everybody to keep researching and keep pursuing the sources behind this story.
And let me make one other plug while we're there. Jeffrey McCullough and Steve O'Neill have created the most amazing archival experience display in saying that, but it is truly phenomenal. And if you haven't been up there, you may have never been up there in your entire time at Furman yet, go up there to the top floor of the library and see the amazing display they have. It's comprehensive of a lot of the documents that Steve used in this report, but also more. There are leads to 1,000 other research projects that are there. I just saw Melinda Menzer on the way here, and the Jewish history in Greenville is something that we don't really know much about, and it's amazing. And the documents there about some of the anti-Semitic violence on the outbreak of the Civil War, it couldn't go in our report because it's not our report, right? But just amazing findings that immediately could spur class after class of research and conversation. Connecting that history to today and understanding that it's just fantastic. So do go see the exhibit. It'll be open homecoming weekend as well. Any other announcements there? I guess that's probably good enough. But yeah, otherwise 12 to 5. Go back.
Hey, this is kind of a request to put on my hat as chair of the staff advisory council here for a moment. But I think that we would like to see inclusion of staff, particularly outside of academic affairs, in some of the future initiatives, if there are advisory groups or committees that are on the task force or other ways to participate. I think that there are staff across campus who would be excited, passionate, interested, who need an opportunity, direction, and also conversations with their division heads and supervisors to support letting them do some of this work, even if it's not directly related to their job. So I think in academic affairs, I'm very lucky that I have a very supportive division heads who will allow me to do something like this if I were asked to or if I had the opportunity to. But I think that the lower down you get in, you know, an organization, you start at the top and you can get a little less freedom to move away from your job description. And I think there's a lot of people at different levels in the university who would love to participate but haven't been given the support or the avenue to do so.
Yeah, just an anecdote there. In talking to one person who works with facilities about this, we just had some of these pictures out at a freshman event, and she just sort of squinted at them and said, "What's this about? You know, what's going on? I haven't been part of the events today," and just barely started a conversation with her. And she said, "Oh, so you mean students might start to see our labor and not think it's invisible and behind the scenes, but in fact sort of acknowledge that we're here and that we're doing the work to carry on the way to the university?" And I said, "Exactly, that's what we hope. And here are some examples of where that would be the case. If it's a Murphy dorm, then there's a living exhibit of the kind of labor he did for the school. The bricks in the different areas of campus become another symbol of labor. And then, of course, actually Elizabeth Davis, our president, recommended focusing on that in one of the recommendations that we would talk still about. labor and equity in the university's pay structure, which was a great recommendation. So yeah, it's been a very collaborative process. It's not like we're having to be, you know, adversarial in any of this. And so those kinds of ideas, if we can find a way to champion that, I'd be happy to do it. I think I've already said this, but one thing is the task force created the report, and we don't have a charge beyond that. You know, we are here, we're advisory, we're willing to help and give feedback wherever we can, drive things when we need to, but we did our job. And so the question then is what next? And there's several avenues where that's gonna become very important. One of those being, WIFF gave us a coverage recently, and they said, task force wants to change the motto. And I said, well, that's not exactly right? Because we said we would reconsider the motto in light of all the, reconsider the motto, the mission, values, a lot of other things in light of what we found. And I think that's not our job. I think there's a level of participation and input that just wasn't there in the room in terms of this particular historical task force. It needs to be a broader conversation about who we are and who our identity is. So lots of areas like that embedded in these recommendations where there needs to be a group that helps give feedback as they come to life.
Yeah, I was just going to say another word about process. So when we started this, we didn't have a chief diversity officer. And now we do. Michael Jennings has been with us for a year. He's working on a diversity plan. So a lot of the elements of what we've got in the report and things that we haven't thought of that aren't in the report that are important will be put into a comprehensive diversity plan. So we have a chief diversity officer who reports directly to the president, sits on the president's cabinet, and is present for all high-level conversations. And so that's a process, one of the processes by which we will take ideas like involving staff more and then move them forward.
We're getting low on time, so we'll just maybe one more question.
Good afternoon. I'm Glenn Halbenbauer from Politics and International Affairs, and I wanted to commend my friends and colleagues on the task force for a job well done. I've assigned the task force report in my FYW, which centers on Greenville, and the students' first paper was to take three of the recommendations in the task force that the task force recommended and essentially to agree or disagree with them. So let me just share a few of the points that seem to be coming out in those papers. I haven't read the finished products yet, so these are some of the preliminary thoughts. I think far and wide the most controversial recommendation from the student's perspective is the Joseph Vaughn scholarship. And I think while the students are supportive of it, I think at least some portion of them are wondering if the sort of thrust of the task force about this time in Furman's history when race and the color line was so predominant and that we had this odious system of slavery, have we now created a scholarship that's based essentially on race? And are we, I think, you know, as a person who teaches racial and ethnic politics, I mean, one of the most important sorts of perspectives on race in contemporary United States is the colorblind theory. And I think many of my students in the seminar are infused with a colorblind kind of perspective on race. And the Joseph Vaughn Scholarship, while honoring someone who they recognize as singularly important in the university's history, is racializing a particular scholarship. So that's sort of one perspective, Brandon. The other would be a different kind of take on it, but it's the notion of why is the scholarship so narrowly focused on African Americans, why on these particular regions in South Carolina, and I think they understand that this is part of the reparations kind of perspective. But I think for a certain portion of the students, it's why aren't we thinking more broadly about discrimination that is absolutely representative of things that are going on right today, and perhaps have a more direct link to discriminatory practices, and why are we being narrow in the perspective about where the Joseph Vaughan scholarship would be. Third point, and this is a general sort of point, perhaps I'm having some influence on my students who are not generally going to be politics and international affairs people, but they understand the importance of implementation. And your task force, in fact, has done what it's supposed to do. But good students of public policy know that implementation is as important as formulation or policy or passing a law. And the notion is that the students understand that to do this, there's going to have to be a lot of vigilance and a lot of their questions about recommendations for, well, who's going to implement this? How much money is it going to cost? Who's going to really oversee this? And who's going to be the vigilant person to keep saying, well, what's happened with that recommendation? And so if the trustees embrace it, then what's going to come next?
Which one of those three do you want me to
answer? I think perhaps George, the one that's most clearly in your bailiwick is number three about vigilant implementation.
Well, Michael Jennings is going to have a list of everything that's going to be implemented, and he's our chief diversity officer. So I think in collaboration with the provost office and African Affairs, we're going to make sure that we done those things that we need to do. So this report should be a living document that we use and guide us, like Greg just explained how we use it in this class, and you explain how you use it in your class. And I think that's wonderful. I would like to say something about the scholarships though.
Yeah.
So right now, you know, we have to think about the difference between merit aid and need-based aid. So we bring kids to school now and we gap them. They've got this much need, and we give them this much. So the scholarships are going to help fill in that gap of need-based aid. And so, you know, this is what we would like to become is a place where every student, whatever their FAFSA family contribution is, they pay that family contribution, and whatever the gap is in need-based aid, that you're able to come up with that amount. We're a long ways away from that, but that's what we're trying to get. So I think maybe it's a communication problem with talking about the scholarship as opposed to the actual idea of it.
Yeah, and I'll just say on that one that that was a meeting, Michael Jennings and I with Michael Hendrickson. That was an idea that actually came from them. Now we, the task force took it as our own because we said, well, here's, because of our history that we found, this is the way these recommendations need to be worded, addressed, and all the rest. And so that's going to, there's going to be a layer there, right, of what actually gets implemented in the office versus what we recommended based on. And I think Mike will have the scrutiny there to say, okay, what's going to work here in terms of my office. But he has a mandate from us, and I understand your students' concern. I would say, yeah, that's part of the process. That conversation is the one that we wanted to have happen at the university, is taking seriously that historical arm and reckoning with it, and if you know, at least addressing the question. And again, what that looks like, you know, I would say to the students, what that looks like in practice is this office that had a lot of policies and a lot of variables at play, making some really meticulous kinds of decisions with it that again are outside of the purview of our task force. The great thing to do there is invite him into your class and have him talk about some of the ways that sort of recommendation might be implemented, because he had a plan for what it looked like, and again, I couldn't possibly get into it about how he's going to accomplish that. But it's a plan, and he had it for us. Again, one of the nice things about doing this task force is we went to a lot of these offices and said, "What does it look like for you guys to be a real player here? I mean, if we were going to push you, to do something really dramatic and really spectacular in your office, what would it look like? And they generally responded. That's probably all the time we have. So, thank you so much. Just a few closing announcements. There is the slavery.justice@furman.edu email address. You'll find it on all these websites as well. Take some time to, if you have some thoughts following up from this forum that you want to put into writing, please send them there, because that's the sort of thing that I'm going to aggregate and hand to the trustees and say, here's what we've got. Here's the massive data that we've collected. We've been taking minutes of this meeting, so it's nothing will be lost, but at the same time, it becomes a lot easier to tick it away and quantify some of that when it's sitting there in a database. We look forward, just like as you do, to what's going to happen here at the end of the month with the trustees and in the year to come. We ask for your continued support. And like I said, the task force is sort of done, but all of the people who served have a relatively intricate knowledge of this process and this project. So I would say, don't look to George or me or anybody else necessarily. Look to anybody that served on that task force. Ask them, where was that coming from? What are you guys going to do with that? How do we make that real? How do we work this into a larger system, maybe than even the document could glimpse? So thank you so much for coming out today. I really appreciate it. Take care.
No, but she's doing pretty good. This just sounds like a really good idea.